Good morning. Private sector giving is changing its approach, looking for ways to direct giving according to each donor's preferences. Foodland CEO Janai Wall is here to talk about the Give Aloha program and its role in our community. And Hawaii's hospitals are dramatically reducing the number of readmissions. Kathleen DeBow-Lego of the Healthcare Association of Hawaii is here to tell us how they did it. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Bill Sage. No conquistadors this time, just Spain and the New World for your listening pleasure. Plus a young lady who's been nationally recognized for her hands-on way of giving back.
It's Thursday, September 22nd. Those conversations and a few more after the news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Bill Sage.
Good morning, Chris Vandercook. Seems like it's going to be a better day.
It is, and we're going to think about giving this morning because we're kind of heading into that season. And most of us understand the need for charitable giving. The world is full of people less fortunate than ourselves, but we want to have a pretty good idea of how our donations are being spent. And we want to direct our own limited resources in a way that reflects our specific concerns. Foodland Supermarket has tailored its Give Aloha program accordingly, giving donors choices in their manner of giving. Janai Wall is the chairman and chief executive officer of Foodland Supermarket Limited. She's with us this morning. Good morning, Janai.
Good morning, Chris.
This is a program whose success surprised you at first, right?
Yes, it really did. You know, we had started this program in 1999 mm-hmm. in memory of my father, and my dad was so... He believed in the importance of giving back to the community, mm-hmm. and we wanted to keep that spirit of giving alive, and we thought, what better way than to inspire giving in others? And we didn't want to pick an organization for our customers to give to. We thought, wow, wouldn't it be nice if people could choose, because we don't care where they give. We mm-hmm. just want them to experience the joy my dad did by giving and supporting other people.
You know, you use the word inspire giving in others, and I think that's a key thing because people are very touchy about how their giving is solicited. If they feel strong-armed, they're not going to do it.
That's true.
Right? They just want to be very – you just have to be very careful in how you approach that, don't you?
Yes, and I think that people in Hawaii really like to give. You know, they – give to car washes, and they buy chili, and
sure.
they do all sorts of other things. And I think sometimes people do it in small ways, and so they don't want to feel like they're forced to give to something, but they also want to be able to feel good about giving what they can.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we wanted to do with Give Aloha was make it easy for people to give. And so if you want to give a few cents, if you want to give a dollar, we don't care. We just want you to support in some way. Or give you the opportunity to support the organizations you care about in the community.
You know, like most grocery chains, you have a sort of a customer, I don't know what you call it, kind of a customer identification
mm-hmm.
system. You get a card, and mm-hmm. that Maikai card.
Maikai card, yes.
Gives you, you know, discounts on discounted items. And it also, for you, it allows you to sort of monitor preferences, right, customer preferences. But that also gives you an infrastructure that you've applied to this, doesn't it?
Well, you know, we don't look at our customers too much individually.
Mm-hmm.
We're really concerned about their privacy. And what the way Maikai applies with Give Aloha is that you just have to have a Maikai card
mm-hmm.
to give. And the organizations, what we've tried to do is give people a breadth of options, a range of options, so that they can give wherever they choose.
And how do they make those choices? How's that?
So we have over 700 organizations registered in Give Aloha this year. And when a customer comes to the checkout, they receive a list from the cashier. The cashier will say, would you like to give Aloha? and they can pick any one of those organizations. Many of the organizations reach out to their followers, but often customers may not have heard from an organization and they just want to give to something in their community mm-hmm. or something that they care about, and they'll look through the list and select.
A lot of times you might pick a charitable source based on a personal experience.
Yes, that's
right?
True.
If someone in your family has been ill, you might give to research on that
right.
illness, that kind of thing.
Right. So. And I think a lot of times people give to the schools in their community. They might give to their church. You know, it's a wide range of reasons and
yeah.
things that they support. But I think for us, we just get excited that they give, and it doesn't matter to us which of those organizations they give to.
One of the things that people are concerned about when they give is how much does the whole sort of mechanism of giving, how much of my dollar gets taken out just to keep the mailers going, or, you know, whatever
right.
the structure is, yeah?
And so what happens with Give Aloha is that actually nothing gets taken out. It gets added to. So we match with the Western Union Foundation. Foodland matches a portion of every gift. And so in most years, it ends up being somewhere between 25 cents to 30 cents on the dollar that you give.
Mm-hmm.
So everything you give gives more. Even if it's a dollar, you're going to help that organization more than what you would otherwise, because we match a portion of that gift.
You're, you know, one of your hats is as a corporate CEO,
mm-hmm.
running a business that needs to, you know, continue generating profit. And, of course, you deal with other businesses, other CEOs. And do you think that there's a sort of a change of consciousness in the private sector in terms of a sense of responsibility?
I think, especially in Hawaii, there's within the corporate community a strong sense of corporate responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we care about Hawaii, and we're kind of separated from everybody else. We don't always get a whole lot of attention. And I think, you know, when you are part of the community and when you're a local company like we are, you know, one of the things my father instilled in us is that we have a responsibility to give back to the people that support us. And so that's what Give Aloha is all about.
You know, sometimes you hear our small size, relatively small population,
mm-hmm.
and physical isolation. So often we hear those presented as obstacles or problems, but in some ways, having about 1.3 million people,
mm-hmm.
Some ways I think that Hawaii is at a manageable size. You know what I mean?
I agree. I think that's true. And I think, you know, it's a place where individuals and organizations can really make a difference in improving the life here in this community.
Because that's the other thing, and I'm sort of trying to put myself in the mindset of the donor, is that you want to feel that you've had an impact.
Right.
I mean, it sounds selfish. You want to feel that you've had an impact, and you possibly would like to even see
mm-hmm.
evidence of that impact.
I think that's true, and I think that, you know, one of the things we try to tell people through Give Aloha is that every gift matters. It doesn't matter how small it is. You're helping the organization, and you've helped in some way. And, you know, we have over the years had some of our stores in what might be considered the lowest income communities
mm-hmm.
that we serve have the highest percentage of giving. And what that tells me is that people just want to help. They want to help in whatever way they can.
That does tell an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
It really does. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
No, real pleasure to hear about that. Janai Wall is Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Foodland Supermarket Limited. The Give Aloha program is an annual one in which customers are invited to make a donation of up to $249 per person per organization at checkout to their favorite nonprofit organization among those registered in the Give Aloha Foodland program. And you can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13, and coming up, music of Spain and the New World. But first, here's your quiz.
Honolulu's Washington Place has not always been the home of Hawaii's governors. This stately mansion was built for Captain John Dominus and his family in 1846. He died at sea while on a fur trading voyage to China, and his newly widowed wife Mary was left struggling to make ends meet. She had to rent out some of the property's rooms to support herself and her young son John Owen Dominus. But by 1862, the Dominus residence became the home of Lydia Dominus, following her marriage to the now fully grown John. Lydia would become Hawaii's last ruling monarch, Queen Liliuokalani. She would not be the last resident of Washington Place to preside in Hawaii's government, however. Her 55-year stay in the Dominus residence was, of course, just the beginning of a long list of Hawaiian executives. Today's backyard quiz is, can you give us the exact year that Washington Place became the official residence of the Hawaii governors? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Support for today's programming comes from Diamond Head Theater, presenting the musical Billy Elliot, based on the film with music by Elton John, opening tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. Tickets at DiamondHeadTheater.com.
The music of Spain and the New World started half a millennium ago, and to hear the intricate beauty of this unplugged era's sound is something we don't often get to experience. We need a virtuoso, a lutenist, and a baroque guitarist to bring it back. And today, we're very fortunate indeed to have such a virtuoso, guitarist and lutenist Hideki Yamaya. He's performed for audiences worldwide. He's going to perform on Honolulu, and he joins us in studio this morning. Aloha, Hideki.
Hi.
So you have what looks like a large, beautifully carved ukulele, but this would be the vihuela?
This is the vihuela, yes, and it is actually related to the ukulele, actually. Uh-huh. It is a direct ancestor of the modern guitar, and all the strings are in pairs, and usually the top one is single. But
what's the tuning on that?
This is tuned, well, if you know the guitar tuning, if you drop the third string to F sharp and put a capo on it on the third fret, that's the tuning of this instrument. So it goes from bottom to top, G, C, F, A, D, G.
Okay, now with this particular tuning, what you do is pretty much bring back what a lot of people don't really hear that much. For example, the Baroque, I mean, when Spain pretty much was the kingpin when it came to this new world.
Yes.
They brought the music, which was essentially the High Renaissance.
Yes.
Were they inspired by the new world, and this is some of the pieces you're going to do in your concert?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, in the program, there are the second half is all new world music, so composers from the new world.
So by this time, the new world, we're talking like the 15th, 16th century?
This is 17th century.
Oh, 17th
music.
Century by now. Okay. Yeah. So only 400 years ago. But hey,
yeah,
who's counting?
That's right.
Well, the best way to give us a taste of what that music sounded like, would you mind and tell us what you're going to play?
Sure. I'll play a little snippet from this piece by composer Luis de Narvaez, who wrote a book of vihuela music in the 1530s. And this is a piece called La Canción del Emperador, the Emperor's Song.
Song for the, okay. La Canción del Emperador. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
And that particular piece, when 1530, by this time they're pretty much well established in this new world, maybe.
Well, the composer, this one, was in Spain, so mm-hmm. this was published in Spain. But I mean, Spain has had already established themselves in the New World by this time, and there was musical activity that we can trace back to this time.
Now, just to make sure I'm remembering this right, the vihuela is essentially the Spanish pronunciation of viola.
That's correct.
Same sort of general shape, and this particular instrument, you said there are versions that were also bowed?
Yeah, viola was a generic term for mm-hmm. a stringed instrument back then, so this instrument specifically was called viola da mano, the viola of the hand.
Ah.
And in Spanish that would have been vihuela de mano.
I see.
But vihuela de arco would be a viola that was played with a bow.
Aha. Well, since you are using da mano, can you give us another little snippet of something?
Sure.
This particular piece will be what?
This is Guardame las Vacas by the same composer.
Also was lovely. What's the translation
Thank
of the
you.
Title?
title means "Watch the cows for me,"
okay.
And I have no idea why it is called that. But that was a very common chord progression that a lot of composers wrote music to. So it was a common title.
Sort of just well, it's always good to remember that no matter when you're writing, it's modern music.
That's right.
So he was probably being hip. Hey, here's a little gig I wrote called Watch the Cows for Me. Now, the other instrument you have in studio, this is a time I wish I could hold it up to the microphone, but radio just doesn't work that way. But we'll have some of these pictures on Facebook. This is an actual Baroque guitar, is that correct?
That is right.
Okay. Unfortunately, time has a way of flying out, but ironically, the Baroque guitar looks less like a guitar than the vihuela does, but it's got the most beautiful filigree on it. And I imagine back in those days it would have been ivory, but for now, again.
It was mostly common made in parchment, as it is on this one. Yeah.
Oh, my heavens. Mm-hmm. So that's even more surprising discovery. Well, as time starts to flee with us a little bit, could you play us a snippet of what that beautiful
sure
instrument
thing.
Sounds like?
Yes.
And what would this be called?
This is jacaras, a type of dance written by Santiago de Murcia, who actually made it to Mexico. He was a Spaniard and left a book of guitar music in Mexico.
Wonderful. Here we go. Lovely. I want to thank you so much for being with us this morning, Hideki.
Thank you.
And the concert is going to be Saturday night at 7:30 at the Lutheran Church on Punahou Street?
That is correct.
All right. Well, thanks again and best of luck in your endeavors for the rest of your career. May everybody else be able
thank
to get
so
unplugged. Hideki Yamaya, internationally acclaimed lutenist guitarist, performing once again at the Lutheran Church in Honolulu, 7:30 Saturday night, Spain and the New World. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for more details.
To sustain is to provide what is needed for something to continue. It's exactly what HPR sustaining members do. They know their monthly gifts mean a steady, predictable income for the station, and that the station couldn't survive without them. Sustainers are part of the reason HPR comes to everyone, every day, in two program streams. So please help your public radio station continue to thrive by pledging $10 a month. Call us at 955-8821 and become a sustaining member at hawaiipublicradio.org. Thanks.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the law firm Alston, Hunt, Floyd, and Ng, serving clients and the community in Hawaii for a quarter century. More information online at ahfi.com.
Reports of abuse of foreign crew members aboard international fishing vessels have been an open secret for years, but only recently has the local industry been forced to address them. Now the Hawaii Longline Association is reminding us of the legal loopholes that allow U.S. vessels to hire foreign workers and pay them far less. Chad Blair has more in this morning's Civil Beat Reality Check. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Chris.
It's legal to pay foreign workers less, right?
It is, and we're talking about that Associated Press story that broke a couple of weeks ago and describing people working, these fishermen, foreign fishermen on U.S. boats, under what is described as slave-like conditions for as low as $350 a month. But what Nathan Eagle, our reporter, found out when talking to the longline industry and others is that, in fact, it's perfectly legal under the law. There is an exemption in federal law that was carved out nearly 30 years ago by the U.S. Congress that allows this to actually happen.
Mm-hmm. You know, it reminds me. Go ahead, Chad. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. I was going to say the exemption itself, the idea was to Americanize the U.S. Fleet, sort of like the Jones Act, which we all know applies to ships here in Hawaii and a few other places. The idea was to make sure that if you have a U.S. flag ship, that it be built in the U.S. and crewed by Americans. But this exemption that I was telling you about made it specifically for tuna and swordfish fishermen. Why? Because these are highly migratory species. And because of that, along with a few other things that happened, for example, West Coast vessels setting up shop in Hawaii, the Pacific Islands, moving away from the West Coast, a number of other things, led to hiring many more foreign workers. And today, nearly all of these longline vessels are crewed by foreigners.
Which is why the price of fish is what it is, right, Chad?
It certainly does have a lot to do with that. Another thing that happened along these same lines were depleted stocks. That, of course, is driving up fishing prices.
Mm-hmm.
There was a pressure to stop killing dolphins. As you know, these long nets were catching dolphins, and that's a no-no. Also, just a staffing problem, getting Americans to work. So what you do is you go and you hire these foreign workers. And today, the longline industry has about 140 of these ships, all told, most of them here, most of them foreign crewed.
It's almost as if the legal loopholes made it an economic necessity to hire foreign crews to keep your own costs down.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. But the AP story has really fired up a lot of our lawmakers, particularly mm-hmm. state lawmakers, the congressional delegation. They're trying to find ways to fix the law. You know, even you can't even use a temporary working or visitor visa. It does not apply to these workers who literally have to stay on the boats when they're here. In town, they cannot get off the ship. And some of the boats are not very well equipped at all in terms of amenities.
This is one of those stories that's being addressed after being around for a long time, isn't it?
Right. As you said, this is not something that was completely new, but kudos to the AP for getting this out and for our Nathan Eagle furthering our understanding of the situation.
Amen to that. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Chris.
Every day we bring you a reality check with Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair. And at 8:34, you're back with the conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. It's one of the proven metrics of health care, rates of hospital readmissions. It's one that's easy enough to understand, and it's one that Hawaii's medical community watches closely. The good news is that Hawaii had the steepest drop in hospital readmissions in the nation between 2010 and 2015. Kathleen Libau-Lego, an RN, is the Director of Quality and Regulatory Affairs at the Healthcare Association of Hawaii. She's with us to help us sort out the data. And Kathleen, this is really your full-time occupation, isn't it? Keeping an eye on things like this.
Yes, sir.
Well, why focus on hospital readmissions? What do we learn from that?
A big focus came on hospital readmissions from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. Mm-hmm. So essentially the health programs, right, for the elderly and for the low-income population. And as we know, America spends billions of dollars. And so the estimate from CMS is that $17 billion are spent on readmissions. So it's very important.
So that figure, the cost of a readmission, is makes things difficult for any healthcare facility because it's usually right an unanticipated cost. It's sort of adding to what you didn't expect you were going to have to pay. Yeah,
that's correct. So that's what CMS tracks. What all the hospitals look at is readmissions within 30 days mm-hmm. from a hospital discharge.
What do you think are the factors that lead to the need for a readmission? What are the things that you guys track about that?
Well, there are many conditions that are very complex, and so not all readmissions are unanticipated. But you can imagine when you look at the high cost and high medically complex patients, such as those with heart failure, pulmonary lung disease, mm-hmm. you know, stroke, those are the high ticket items as yeah. well as complex patients. So that's what it started out with, the focus on readmissions.
What are the things that you address in order to get that number down? You know, it's one thing to sort of know where the problem is. I'm not sure. I'm sort of wondering how you pinpoint what to do about it.
Well, I just want to take the moment to really congratulate our hospitals because with this focus, it was really looking at the entire process of readmissions. So they have implemented, you know, best practices. So, for example, you know, some hospitals give a 30-day supply of medications when the patient's being discharged mm-hmm. and have a pharmacist do that education on the medications instead of just giving a prescription, you know, on the last day on the way out the door.
Mm-hmm. Because to just build on that example, you might postpone going to the pharmacy for a day when you shouldn't do that or any number of things. Random factors can enter in, right?
Exactly. You might not be able to physically drive and go to the pharmacy. Mm-hmm. You might not have someone at home or have those structural supports in place to help you post.
Yeah, I think a lot of discharges seem anyway to be maybe based on an assumption that there's a separate bedroom and somebody to kind of bring you food and sustenance, but not true for everybody, right?
Right. Even we have a lot of homeless people,
sure.
for example.
Sure.
So, yes, a lot of factors in play.
Well, the whole idea of monitoring where things go wrong in hospital care, how did that become your focus? I'm sort of wondering what it is that you study. What are the things that you look at in coming up with a number like that, with numbers like these?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of things are dictated to hospitals. You know,
sure.
healthcare is one of the, if not the most heavily regulated or over-regulated industries, especially in our nation.
Yeah.
But because readmissions are high cost and mm-hmm. the government's looking at that to decrease spending and improve quality of care, readmission was chosen as one of the measures to focus on.
And it actually, you were telling me, we talked before the show, that readmission actually gets high rates of readmission get penalized, yeah?
That's correct. CMS implemented the Hospital Readmissions Reduction Program back in 2012. But simultaneously, they also implemented a National Hospital Quality Improvement Initiative called the Partnership for Patients, and readmissions was a major focus of that, and many of our hospitals joined in the partnership in the first and second rounds.
You know, I'm inclined to think that an improvement program makes, just to my civilian ears, makes more sense than penalizing readmissions, right, than a punishment program. Does it seem that way to you?
Sure. What I tell people is that is the all stick and no carrot program. Yeah. But we still have to, you know, do what is expected of us and do our best. And I think our hospitals are doing a great job in many areas, and readmissions is one of them.
Yeah. Well, the thing about the all stick and no carrot, and I tend to agree with what you're describing, is that it doesn't, I mean, readmissions can happen through no fault of anyone, can't they?
Sure. And, you know, zero readmissions is not a goal for hospitals or CMS. I mean, that is just not.
Sometimes it's the best thing you can do, right?
Exactly. There's some recent research from Johns Hopkins that says, you know, some of the largest teaching hospitals, because they see some of the sickest patients, and the ones with the sickest patients might have the highest readmission rates, but their mortality rates, you know, for heart failure, things like that, are the best. So
you really don't want, and you don't want to start penalizing hospitals for taking on sick people, right? That would sort
not
of,
at all. None of our hospitals are going to turn a patient away because it's within the 30 days.
Yeah. But it does strike as it's an odd way to address a problem. It also sounds as if hospitals are on their own addressing the problem through improvement programs. Yeah.
Yes, I mean at least the providers, and I mean every person that works in the hospitals, have common goals, and no one goes in there to try to do a bad job. So we're just happy that Hawaii came out on top after this. You know, look at the data for 2010 to 2015.
Yeah.
It's impressive. So this is a bright spot for Hawaii as a whole, especially our hospital members.
Well, it would really seem that it could be a sort of a source of a little bit of regional pride to keep that keep those statistics where they are, getting even better maybe.
Absolutely. We've set the bar. Where can we go?
There you go. Kathleen, thanks so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, it's a good news story, isn't it? Kathleen DeBow-Lego, an RN, is the Director of Quality and Regulatory Affairs at the Healthcare Association of Hawaii. She's helping the Healthcare Association membership improve its performance in areas such as hospital readmissions and infection control. She also coordinates the Partnership for Patients program, a federally funded effort to help hospitals improve their performance. And you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of.
It's just something that we
wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Paul Mancini is a very interesting fellow. He's a voracious reader, was in the Peace Corps in Micronesia, and taught law in Alaska. He's a partner in the law firm Mancini, Welsh, and Geiger, and sits on the board of directors for Hawaii Public Radio. Paul is a member of the Hawaii Community Foundation's Leadership Council for Maui. He says it gives him something positive to do with his time. His family inherited some money, so they established the Albano Maka Alohi Lohi Scholarship to honor his grandmother. It helps people recovering from mental health issues or with behavioral or psychological disabilities attend college or pursue vocational training. In every situation, he tries to focus on aloha and give opportunities to others. You can do things to help people, he says, and when you do, you help yourself significantly. And then he adds, it's a very nice feeling. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
Good morning. I'm Stuart Scott from Transition University. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Tonight at 5, guest host Colin Moore moderates Town Square. Hello, Colin.
Good morning.
Well, we got some interesting coverage about the national media and local media. Do they generally enlighten or confuse voters? You're going to cover that, eh?
That's right. We sure are. We're going to start off by just giving folks a sense of how reporters think about covering campaigns, what stories they choose to cover, what stories they ignore. And try to give people a chance to ask all of their questions. I mean, everyone's a critic of the media, and so they'll have a chance to ask some seasoned reporters this evening.
Seems like some people say that next to Congress, they trust the media even less. Is that what's happening now?
That's right. I mean, as polarization in the U.S. has increased, the media has been part of that. I mean, whether they've driven it or just followed the demands of the public is another question I think we'll get into tonight.
Yes, yeah, so a lot of people, depending on which side of the aisle you happen to be on, people start grousing that reporters are no longer reporters. They're editorializing and they should stick to facts. It sounds like the whole school of journalism, to some, might be changing.
I think that's right, and I think that's what the journalists on the program tonight are going to talk about. It's become, I think, very difficult for them to stay objective when you have a candidate like Donald Trump who, frankly, lies quite frequently.
Mm-hmm. And so the... But the people on the other side still yell the same thing about candidate Hillary Clinton. So it seems like, wait, what about taking a deep breath and getting objectivity back somehow? Is that in the school of journalism these days?
Well, it certainly is. It's certainly their hope. But it's become more and more difficult. Of course, there's more economic pressure on journalists. So it's tough, but we'll get into these questions tonight.
It's going to be a good one. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That's tonight at 5, guest host Colin Moore moderating Town Square.
Washington Place is home to Hawaii's current governor, has been the residence of our state's top executive for quite some time. Yet before it was the official residence of the governor's, since this year we asked you to give us, it was a private residence. The mansion was built in 1846 by sea captain and fur trader John Dominus for himself and his wife and young son. On a fur trading expedition to China, the ship was lost and John Dominus was never heard from again. His widow rented out the rooms of the property to make ends meet for herself and her son, John Owen Dominus, who became the husband of Queen Liliuokalani. The queen lived there until her death in 1917, and in 1922, Washington Place became the official home for Hawaii governors, which it remained up until 2008 when the current governor's residence was built on the same grounds. That's your backyard quiz question for today. Many thanks to Sally Hill for providing the story behind today's quiz question. And, Bill, no winners today, huh? I'm sorry to hear that. Well, tomorrow's another day. If you've got a quiz for us, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org at 8:47. That's today's quiz.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA FlexPlus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Imagine being a little kid experiencing the fear and anxiety of homelessness, wondering where your next meal will come from, wondering if you and your family will be safe, wondering if you'll ever have a reason to hope. This happened not so long ago to our next guest. She and her family relied heavily on the support of local food banks, beginning when she was a young girl, and as she grew up, she sought a way to stop the cycle. She became a role model for children across the country with her organization, The Future Isn't Hungry, which she founded in Hawaii 6 years ago. She is Brittany Amano, and she joins us by phone this morning. Aloha, Brittany.
Hi.
So you've done something absolutely remarkable for someone at, you're what, 18 now?
I'm 19.
Oh, 19. Okay.
Yes.
much more grown up. But
yes.
What was it that gave you the inspiration and hope to do something so amazing?
I think for me, it was, you know, seeing my grandma become homeless and just wanting to give back to all the organizations that had helped her get back on her feet and, you know, helped me and my mom, you know, get back on our feet. And for that, it was the local food banks and the local homeless shelters that really helped us out. And I just really wanted to give back to them and thank them for everything they did. But I never imagined that it would become this big and now be in all 50 states.
So when you started out this, back in 2010, take us from homelessness and hopelessness into that moment of hope. Was it an aha moment, or did it evolve gradually for you?
I don't know if it was an aha moment, but I gathered four of my closest friends in the fourth grade mm-hmm. and decided to start a small food drive in my elementary school. I went to Alwa Elementary School, and we, you know, were able to raise a humble amount of 700 pounds of food, and that's how it started. That small amount taught me that even though I was only 9 years old at that time, I could really make a big difference. And I kept on doing small projects such as that. And then it continued to grow. And then when I was 12, I learned what a nonprofit was after going to DC for a community service award that I received called the Prudential Spirit of Community Awards. And I met 49 other youth who are my age who are doing remarkable things and so passionate and had nonprofits and were doing amazing things to better the world in various areas. And after learning what a nonprofit was, I decided I wanted to continue making a difference, but on a larger scale. So that's when I started The Future Isn't Hungry.
So when The Future Isn't Hungry began, at this point, you're what age? You're 13, 14?
I'm 12.
12. My
yeah.
heavens. So when you got to the recognition came because of what you did in elementary school, and that's how you got to Washington, D.C.?
Yeah.
Okay, so once you were there, the organization which sees you doing this, they say, okay, we're going to help you fund this idea. Is it sort of like a Kickstart, a startup? What's the dynamic behind it?
So how it started was I went to local businesses and talked to adults that were in the nonprofit and government sector and had a lot of help that way, and then talked to other youth that I met on the trip who had organizations set up already to start The Future Isn't Hungry. And then we got a small group of youth volunteers and literally just knocked on doors, you know, went to business to ask for donations. And it started as a small, humble organization that, you know, was able to feed, you know, a few hundred people here and there, and has now been able to feed over 1 million people all across the country.
Well, that seems like it's just if you are going door to door and knocking on doors, it's
mm-hmm.
it seems like to get in all 50 states, does social media do a lot of the spreading for you? I mean, do people start calling you? Is there a critical mass point where people say, hey, I want to be a part of what you're starting?
Yeah, it was a lot of it was after receiving the National Jefferson Award for Public Service.
Mm-hmm.
The Jefferson Award is the equivalent for the Nobel Prize for Public Service. And after receiving that, I received a lot of support from national organizations in order to replicate my project in all 50 states. So a lot of it was social media and getting the word out through different social media platforms, but it was also creating a toolkit and running hunger training summits in different parts of the country to train youth on how to start branches of The Future Isn't Hungry and work with local food banks in those areas.
So you actually focus on the younger people themselves to be a part of it, not just adults, for the actual sort of hands-on?
Yes. The Future Isn't Hungry, what makes it so special is it's 100% youth-run. And while we do have a few adults who come in to, you know, drive people around or, you know, come and volunteer, mm-hmm. most of our volunteers are youth under the age of 18. And it really just educates youth that they can make a difference. And by educating them that they can make a difference, then they feel empowered to make a difference of their own and either take leadership within the Future Isn't Hungry or start an initiative of their own.
So in all 50 states, is it a mixture of both urban and rural? You try to focus on the areas where hunger most and homelessness most often occur?
Yeah, it's a mix of urban and rural. We look for elementary schools that have a high percentage of students who rely on free or reduced lunch, and we target those schools because a lot of those students don't have anything to eat once the school day is done on Friday. They have nothing to eat on the weekends, and they come home to an empty fridge. And then they come to school on Monday really, you know, not feeling it, not focusing, because they haven't eaten anything for a couple of days.
Yeah.
So by giving them bags of food on Fridays to take home, we are ensuring that they are receiving the nutrition they need when school isn't in session. So we're in all 50 states in a mix of areas.
Now, when you these people, these volunteers, I imagine you went, hey, I started this when I was 12. Why should youth be any barrier to getting? It seems like there's so much cynicism in the adult population. And is there a technique for overcoming this initial suspicion and distrust that many adults would naturally have? Sort of like, hey, are these kids trying to scam me? How do you get through?
Definitely.
What's the main technique? Just open sincerity and they can see. How do you melt those hearts?
Well, so when I started, nobody believed that I could actually make a difference, and they were saying that, you know, what I was doing was a waste of time. You know, I should wait until I'm older and then I'll be able to make a difference. But for me, I was very persistent and told myself that I wasn't going to take no for an answer. So that's initially how it started, was people just saw how stubborn I was and how I wasn't willing to give up. So that's when people started listening and started helping me out bit by bit. And then after I proved to them that I was actually able to make a difference, even if it was a small one, they started wanting to get involved more. And then now when other youth are in other countries, they often say, you know, that this was started by someone when she was 12 years old, and she's been able to raise over $5.3 million for her organization.
Wow.
And been able to feed all of these people all across the country. So if she could do it, then I can too.
Exactly.
Because I was just any other kid. I wasn't, you know.
Well, I have to say.
Just like they were.
I have to say, Brittany, you're not just any other kid. You are a kid who showed that any kid is very special and can make a difference. I want to thank you so much for what you've done and for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
All right. God bless you, and aloha, Brittany Amano. She founded The Futurists in Hungary, a project that combats malnutrition and youth living in under-resourced and low-income housing through peer mentoring, cooking lessons, donations, and nutritious food and school supplies, and it's all over the country. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Next time in Studio 360.
I was always a fan of that kind of twist in the tale, spooky, creepy, what if, speculative fiction.
Charlie Brooker's TV series Black Mirror is the twilight zone for our digital age. It's smart and strange and great, and a new season is imminent. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Friday at 4 p.m. following Fresh Air.
So, Bill, the message would seem to be, don't let anybody tell you you can't make a difference, right?
I mean, a sort of, wait till you're older. Well, if I wait, I might not get older. But the whole show today, Chris, there's a lot of good, positive people out there.
That's right. That's right. It's almost enough to encourage one.
Let's come back tomorrow.
Exactly. And that's the show for today. On tomorrow's agenda, top takeaways from the governor's wastewater forum for the West Hawaii community with DLNR's Bruce Anderson.
And we'll meet Rap Replinger's biographer, Lisa Stone.
We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of the show, or if you want a past one, you can find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and, of course, topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Bill Sage.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Meet us in the morning for more of the Conversation.